This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by calling 877-500-5266. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Beaverton City Council passed a resolution yesterday outlining regulations on political spending. The resolution calls for a national constitutional amendment allowing legislatures to regulate and limit campaign financing. A local group called Beaverton Citizens for Fairness first brought the resolution before the Beaverton City Council in March of last year. After the 2010 Citizens United decision, in which the Supreme Court ruled that corporations can donate money to any campaign they wish under the First Amendment, the debate has raged over whether corporations should be treated with the same rights as private citizens. Campaign finance activists, such as the 10 members of Beaverton Citizens for Fairness, have been pushing for political spending regulation. Voters have passed resolutions similar to Beaverton's, calling for a national amendment in several Oregon cities, including Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, and Coos Bay.
Mayor Charlie Hales announced this morning that a sidewalk will be built on Southeast 136th Avenue, where last month, 5-year-old Morgan Maynard Cook was hit by a car and killed. Many streets in our outer southeast Portland lack sidewalks, making walking alongside them and crossing streets dangerous for pedestrians. This was made clear in last week's street audit, prompting Mayor Hales' decision. Hales announced the decision to build the sidewalks at a press conference this morning near 136th and Holgate, saying that the sidewalk will extend from Holgate Boulevard to Powell on 136th Avenue. Spokeswoman Dana Haynes elaborated, saying that the construction project will begin in the fall and will cost the city $1.2 million.
The Portland Public School District presented data at Monday's school board meeting that revealed that students of color are more likely to be disciplined and disciplined more harshly than white students. African American students were 4.1 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white counterparts. Latino and Native American students are also being severely disciplined at a higher rate than white students. School board members are looking for ways to reduce these numbers and to make school a positive experience for students of all racial groups. KBOO's Jennifer Kemp spoke with Mary Lee, the director of the Multnomah County Commission on Children, Families, and Communities.
Are there more suspensions and expulsions among students of color in schools with a higher number of minority students?
Well, I think a couple things. One is you see this kind of data, and it's very disturbing. Nobody, regardless of your race or ethnic background, wants to see this kind of data. And it's human to want to try to see, well, what's the reason? There's got to be some reason for this. I haven't seen the Portland Public Schools data, but in our experience when the Commission on Children, Families, and Community did their research 2 years ago, when we solved for those kinds of questions about, you know, are there just more people of color in that school, you still see disproportionate rates of suspension, expulsion, and other sorts of discipline. In any school, students of color are more likely to be disciplined than white students.
So why do you think this trend is occurring?
Well, I think in some ways it's both simple and complex. Simply, we live in a country that was built upon and continues to, you know, stand upon racism. And we have a public education system that I would argue doesn't serve any of our children, but particularly is failing at serving our children of color.
Do you think that students of color are disciplined more harshly than white students for exhibiting the same behavior?
Well, that is the result that we found in the work that the commission did in its study, which the interpretation of what the behavior was and what it signified and what it represented was fairly consistently associated with a greater intent for students of color in terms of violence, severity, and appropriateness than it was for students who were not students of color.
What would be an example of that? Like, what would be like a particular disciplinary problem that might occur that might be perceived differently depending on who did it?
Well, you know, I think manners of communication. Someone might perceive that the way in which a student of color communicates or responds to an adult request or direction could be disrespectful, could be, you know, insubordinate, could be, violent, when in fact that wasn't the intent nor the experience of the child of color involved.
Do you think there could be a cultural difference at play?
I absolutely think so. I think there are, you know, culturally based methods of communication, and if the person who is interacting with that child is not of the same culture or does not understand the cultural methods of communication, there absolutely is room for confusion and misunderstanding.
What kind of long-term negative effects happen to kids as a result of being frequently disciplined at school?
Well, I think it's completely linked to our achievement gaps for kids of color, right? It's not an accident that we have these types of disciplinary numbers and these types of achievement gaps.
And what kind of things do you think can be done to keep students of color from being suspended and expelled so often?
Well, one is, I think, and this is where I would applaud Portland Public Schools and the other school districts in our community, you first have to ask the question, gather the data, and look at it, right? So you have to understand what actually is happening, which I think all of our school districts are doing right now. Then you have to say, given that we know this to be true and understand it, and there isn't an answer such as there's more students of color in this school and proportionally it's okay, or, you know, once you solve for sort of those easy reasons, you have to then accept that there is some kind of disparity going on, and then have the conversation about what is the appropriate and right action to take. I think in many cases there are simple answers to these things that, given the understanding that it's happening and a commitment to take action, can be solved.
What kind of action specifically?
Well, you know, I think it's important to have teachers be aware of this data, to let them know that in their own class, you know, if four out of the five of their most frequent flyers who are getting sent down to the office for disciplinary reasons are children of color, that's an issue that the teacher needs to understand. Then they need to be able to both be given tools and training about how to address alternative forms of discipline and held accountable for practicing those alternative forms of discipline. I also think there's a general problem in all of our public school system where, you know, you want to make sure that the majority of children who are in school and having appropriate behavior are able to learn, but we end up sending kids out of school, which is entirely the wrong direction for children who are marginalized and at risk of not being successful academically in the first place.
This is Jennifer Kemp for KBOO News.
KBOO volunteers have stepped up their game to bring you this locally produced newscast every single evening. So now we are asking you to do the same. Joining us now are Zale and Ross to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
Well, you call, and that's the way to do it. Dial 877-500-5266. That's our toll-free number anywhere in the United States. Call us now. Pledge your new membership or renewing membership. No matter how you do it, you've already brought us to our goal for the last hour during Democracy Now! We exceeded our goal, and we are two-thirds of our goal toward our goal of $90,000. We're over $65,000 now. You just need to go to the website, kboo.fm, up in the top right corner, click on the Donate Now button, or call
877-500-5266. Become a member. Become a member or renew your membership like Bonnie did from Washougal. Thanks, Bonnie. We are so happy to know that Bonnie is going to continue her support of KBOO Radio, and we're encouraging you to continue your support as well or become a member for the first time. And the way you do that is you dial 877-500-5266 or you go to the website kboo.fm.
Well, important news is coming up in the hour. Very, very important news. And I saw this come out last night from the partnership for Civil Justice. They're releasing all the documents on the spying on Occupy across the country. And this is an important story that's going to come up in the next segments of the news broadcast. We really want you to look forward to that and all the great news and information you get from KBOO. But the only reason that news comes out with this great team of volunteers, this awesome staff, this terrific radio station, happens because you call 877-500-5266 and pledge your support. Send in those hard-earned dollars to make this radio station thrive and stay alive and continue to bring you this important information.
That's right. You're listening now because this is important to you. KBOO volunteers have spent... KBOO volunteers have gone the extra mile to bring you an hour-long newscast during the membership drive. That's twice as much news as they make for you on a regular night. And why don't you also go the extra mile and show them your support by calling 877-500-5266. Right now, join KBOO. Show your support. Ross?
I think the website's another great way to do it. Plus, you can look at all the great archives, all the schedules, all the information you need to know is at kboo.fm. But no matter how you do it now.
Portland City Council adjusted the arts tax to accommodate for low-income individuals. The change was approved today to waive the tax for citizens who make less than $1,000 a year. The tax has also been pushed to May 15th to accommodate the change, adding an additional $100,000 to the tax's first-year costs. Portlanders approved the arts tax last November, which requires adults to pay $35 annually for local arts programs. The tax's revenue pays for elementary school arts teachers and cultural grants.
The U.S. government routinely kept tabs on Occupy encampments through monitoring and coordinating surveillance, according to new government documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Much of the online surveillance of peaceful activist groups was carried out through the Department of Homeland Security's Fusion Centers, which were set up after September 11, 2001, to analyze terrorist threats. The revelations come as members of Congress debate reforms to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which currently allows the government to access private email content, online conversations, and cell phone location data without a warrant. Alice Olstein with Free Speech Radio News has more.
More than 500 pages of newly released documents from the FBI, Homeland Security, and local police departments show that the government devoted significant resources to tracking peaceful Occupy protests in at least 20 major cities. Attorney Heather Benno with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the organization that obtained the documents, said the memos themselves show that the activists, who largely engaged in lawful First Amendment activity, presented no real danger.
Government agencies knew, for the most part, that these were protests about political issues. They weren't provocateurs, people who were intending to do any harm aside from make demands, political demands, in a grassroots way. And in order to justify using all of the resources that the federal government had at its disposal to intervene and to collect information on this protest movement, it characterized the protest movement itself as a threat.
The heavily redacted documents include intelligence briefings from the Department of Homeland Security's Threat Management Division. Sections include domestic terrorist acts and activity, significant criminal activity, and peaceful activist demonstrations. And Benno says the goal of the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, was not just information gathering.
There was one particular document from Detroit where, for example, there's communication between a law enforcement agent and one of the DHS representatives about having been tasked with coming up with an exit strategy for Occupy. So there were definitely, we have proof in these records to show that there were conversations going on between federal and local law enforcement about getting Occupy encampments broken up.
Some of the government surveillance was carried out in person by uniformed and undercover police, but much of it took place online. because the Electronic Communications Privacy Act hasn't been updated since it was passed in 1986, the government can read the content of most private emails, online chats, and any documents stored in the cloud without getting a warrant. It can also get the geolocation data from the cell phones of private citizens to track their movements. Lawmakers in the House and Senate have introduced legislation to change this, requiring government agencies to prove probable cause of a crime to a judge and get a warrant before they can access this online data. But the bills face opposition from the government agencies engaged in surveillance, including those monitoring the Occupy movement. At a panel discussion at Google's D.C. headquarters on Wednesday, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Jason Weinstein argued that the government needs these spying powers to catch criminals.
In our view, in the department's view, and I think this has been the department's view for a long time, and I think will continue to be, failing to distinguish between the different types of information and requiring a warrant for everything without distinction would impair the government's ability to bring many different types of cases successfully, from identity theft and cyber cases and white collar cases to murder cases and cases that affect people's physical safety.
Weinstein said there should be some method for the government to get online and mobile information that's easier than a warrant, but that agencies should notify the user that their information is being taken and give them the opportunity to challenge the order. Open Internet advocates are mobilizing next week around updating the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and other laws they say are outdated and stifle free expression online. The actions are planned to coincide with the trial that had been scheduled for activist Aaron Schwartz, who was charged with violating another decades-old internet law, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Facing the possibility of a long jail sentence for downloading publicly funded academic articles off the database JSTOR, Schwartz committed suicide in January. His friends and supporters will be calling on Congress members next week to change what they call vague and outdated statutes and, quote, protect innovators and internet users. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
New documents released from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund suggest that monitoring peaceful demonstrations was a matter of general policy. For more on the story, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Ashley Albies of the National Lawyers Guild about the ethics of such coordinated law enforcement efforts.
I'm familiar with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and its goal of gaining documents through public records and Freedom of Information Act requests from the Department of Homeland Security. So based on what the cursory information that I have, it appears that the Department of Homeland Security, in conjunction with the FBI and local law enforcement, including here in Portland, I believe in Portland they've been the Federal Protective Services, have been monitoring the Occupy demonstrations and reporting back. There's been a lot of communication back and forth about those things, about Occupy activities here in Portland.
And is it appropriate for these agencies to conduct such missions in concert or conjunction with the financial services industry?
The PCJF website demonstrates that there's been monitoring of Occupy Portland activities from the Federal Protective Services. But I would say, to the extent that the federal government is monitoring Occupy demonstrators at the behest of large financial institutions, I don't think that would be appropriate.
Any guesstimate on how much publicly developed funds were spent to monitor the Occupy movement here in the state of Oregon?
I don't, but I think that information could be found through public information FOIA requests, public information requests, or Freedom of Information Act requests, and that information may very well be contained on the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund website. I would probably encourage people to go to their website and look at the documents that have been posted. They are in a searchable format so that people can look, plug in Portland, plug in Oregon, and see what information is there.
And in order to file a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, do you have to be affiliated with a media organization?
No, you do not.
You are listening to a membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our volunteers work hard every day to bring you this coverage of local, national, and international news, so now it's your turn. Joining us now are Zale and Ross to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio.
That's right. You can do it by calling 877-500-5266 and joining KBOO or renewing your membership. You know, it's stories like this, Occupy, like the government spying on the Occupy movement. They may mention this on some network news or your local television news, but it would just be in passing, and no way they were going to have an entire story on it. This is the kind of news that you can only get here at KBOO. If you appreciate that news, I know that you do because you're listening right now, please pick up the phone and call 877-500-5266. And when you do, you can always pick up a t-shirt, a fancy t-shirt that we have made here at KBOO.
For
a $90 minimum donation, you can walk about town proclaiming that KBOO Community Radio, it's not just for commie pinko freaks,
self-righteous gutter punks,
drug-addled peaceniks,
anarcho-syndicalists,
hippie tree huggers,
gay hillbillies,
militant vegans,
geriatric deadheads,
or the Foil Hat Brigade.
Not anymore. No. This shirt is awesome. But the way to get that shirt, the easiest way to get that shirt, is to do the $7.50 monthly electronic fund transfer, which I can't even say clearly, but Zale can explain how it works.
Oh, most certainly. It's quite easy. You give us a call. You say you want to start an EFT for $90. We collect a bit of information from you. We mail you a form. You're going to send us back a check for the first month's donation. Then from there on out, every month, you don't have to think about it anymore.
EFT.
$7.50 magically comes out of your account and into ours. We, at the end of the year, will be $90 richer, and you'll hardly notice it. I encourage you to do this right now. Call 877-500-5266 or go to the website kboo.fm. Pick up this t-shirt. In fact, pick up that t-shirt. It's a limited time offer. It's only going to be available for the rest of the drive. Saturday is the last day of the drive.
Time's running out.
Yes, this could be your last time to pick that up. You don't want to miss this exciting opportunity. And the t-shirt, it does come with a warning.
It comes with a warning that, you know, we can't be held responsible for the types of encounters you might have wearing this controversial shirt. And speaking of controversy, there isn't much controversy about the food that the volunteers receive here. As the pledge drive goes on and you call 877-500-5266 to pledge your support, we have three restaurants to thank. They were the ones who fed our volunteers. Thanking the restaurant Toast at 5222 Southeast 52nd Avenue. Thank you, Toast. Then the Daily Grill as well. Daily Grill is at 750 Southwest Alder Street. And Blue Olive. Blue Olive is at 500 Northwest 21st Avenue. All these restaurants have brought food for our volunteers today. Thank you for supporting us. And thank you, members, new members, renewing members, for calling now, 877-500-5266. You know, you may have guessed I'm a news junkie because I talk about the news. I think I dream the news. I snore the news. I sleepwalk the news. And last night, sure enough, I was reading the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund's FOIA request documents. You can get them online. They're very revealing, especially document 2. It's 256 pages of pretty intimate details, although a bunch of it's redacted for national security reasons, obviously. But apparently, before there was even an Occupy Portland encampment in Portland, the General Services Administration, the GSA, was collecting information, deploying agents, putting people in the field in Portland in order to deal with Occupy Portland long before the encampment was there. Well, that's news that you hear about on KBOO in Portland, and that's about it. Nowhere else is going to have that story. Your support for KBOO brings these stories out into the light, gets people information about them. So call now. Support this kind of reporting. This news is important to you. Call 877 800-500-5266 now and pledge your support for KABU.
That's right. Call us right now, 877-500-5266 or 877-500-5266. Call now. Join KABU. Show your support. You know, KABU was set up down there at the Occupy encampment.
We were broadcasting live.
We still have. I think it's a monthly show, Occupy Portland Radio.
Absolutely.
Wednesday nights, monthly. You can listen to that online as well. Past episodes. This is the sort of thing that can only be done with your support. If you continue to call 877-500-5266 or go to the website
kboo.fm, up in the top right corner, donate now. You can also go into the archives and find the Occupy Portland shows. There's also the live audio from Occupy. There's all the great information that you make happen when you become a member now. We'll go back to the news.
A Hanford contractor in Richland, Washington, has agreed to pay $1.1 million to settle a lawsuit out of court brought by the Justice Department, claiming the company lobbied for new government customers for a first responder training facility with federal money. The contractor, Fluor Corp., denied any wrongdoing and claimed it settled to avoid the cost of a legal battle. $200,000 will go to Lloydine Rambo, a former contracting official who filed a whistleblower lawsuit against Fluor in 2011. The Hazardous Materials Management and Emergency Response Facility opened in 1997 to provide training for workers involved in radiation cleanup at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Fluor Corp. operated the training facility for the Energy Department from 1996 to 2009. Consultants were paid almost $700,000 from 2005 to 2008 to lobby other government agencies to use the facility, according to court documents. Rambo's lawsuit alleged that two program officials with salaries paid with federal money lobbied for appropriations that would benefit the training center. Fluor had to certify that it would not use federal money for lobbying under its contractual obligations.
The Connecticut State Senate approved strict gun control laws banning large-capacity magazines and 100 weapons that used to be legal. The bipartisan bill passed 26-10 after a respectful and somber debate. The legislation will go to the House of Representatives, which is expected to pass it, then to Democratic Governor Daniel P. Malloy, who said he will sign it. Malloy had personally informed the parents of the 20 children murdered in the December massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School and championed the cause for gun reform that he hopes will serve as a national model. Senate President Donald E. Williams, Jr., a Democrat, called the bill, quote, the strongest and most comprehensive bill in the country. Gun rights advocates protested the bill at the Capitol, calling it misguided and unconstitutional. They also questioned whether stronger gun control legislation would have stopped the Sandy Hook murderer, Adam Lanza, from killing 20 first-grade children and 6 teachers. Republican State Senator Tony Guglielmo said this bill leaves law-abiding gun owners paying the price for the crimes of one deranged young man. Connecticut joins Colorado, California, and New York as the states with the toughest gun control laws.
While Oregon's 8.9% unemployment rate continues falling at a snail's pace, underemployment in Oregon is still high. According to Oregon's Employment Department, the unemployment rate is nearly doubled when the number of people considered underemployed is counted. The underemployed are classified as workers employed part-time, but who are still looking for full-time work, and people who have stopped looking for work altogether. National figures show Oregon's underemployment rate as the fourth worst in the country, only behind Nevada, California, and Rhode Island. Tim Doy, an economist with the University of Oregon, told the Eugene Register-Guard that the high underemployment rate is having a ripple effect on the economy because of reduced household spending.
You are listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can call to renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by calling 877-500-5266. Stay tuned for Treasures from the Archive at 6, featuring audio from an event recorded by KABU reporters in April 1989, remembering the life of Ben Linder. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rain after 11 a.m. with a high temperature of 63 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's 5:32, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wall Street is a beast, and proud of it. Note that the New York Stock Exchange long ago chose a pair of animals to depict both the market's rampaging power and its voracious nature. One is a snorting bull, representing surging stock prices, and the other is a bear, representing a down market devouring stock value. But Charles, a creative citizen in Holly Hill, Florida, wrote to me suggesting that a third animal is needed to depict the true nature of the Wall Street beast, a hog. Not a little piggy, but a hog, a really big one. Yes, and we could name it Jamie. Jamie Dimon, I mean, the multimillionaire, silver-haired, golden-tongued CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. For years, Dimon and Chase have wallowed in the warm glow of America's financial, political, and media limelight, hailed as paragons of Wall Street management and ethics. But suddenly last summer, a big oink erupted from Chase and Jamie's inner hoggishness surfaced. A $2 billion trading loss, which Dimon haughtily dismissed at first as a tempest in a teapot, turned out to be a staggering $6 billion loss. And now, a scathing Senate report reveals that this was not a mere trade blunder by Chase underlings, but the product of a systemic corporate culture of recklessness, greed, and deception. An internal email from Jamie himself with the words, "I approve," shows that the stench can be traced all the way to the top. Not only did Dimon know what was going on, he enabled it. What we have here is the same triple whammy that hit us in 2007. Ethical rot at the top of banks, sycophantish politicians, and willfully blind bank regulators. This is Jim Hightower saying, won't Wall Streeters ever learn? No, not until prosecutors gut it up and go after them. Our ethical waters will not clear up until we get the hogs out of the creek.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.popular.com.